Hello and welcome to Stoner. Back another week. This week I talked to Jake Lodwick. Jake Lodwick is someone that I originally came across. I think I saw a New Yorker profile that was about the people who founded College Humor, amongst he was one of a set of people, and they were living this kind of proto-internet tycoon loft lifestyle in Manhattan, and I was fascinated. I got to meet him a few years later, and he's quite different than that. He went on to create Vimeo and lots of other companies. The last time I was with him, he had been working on this sampler drum machine for the iPhone. For someone who was so instrumental in the early internet, Jake has surprisingly ambivalent feelings about what he and others unleashed on the world, and was really open about talking about being a different person than he was at 25. I thought he was really fascinating to talk to, and he joined me in the basement studio I have newly constructed, which is the new home of Stoner Interviews when I'm not where I am now, which is Pineapple Street Studios, coming to you live on a Tuesday afternoon, about to post this. If you'd like to get in touch with me, hi@stoner.co. New episodes are available this and every Tuesday. Welcome, Jake Lodwick.
I'm very happy to be here.
I'm always like, I've seen you over the years. I was actually just looking back. I was looking back through your life through Google News history. And I was surprised at how long ago certain events were. But I'm always intrigued as to, like, each time I see you, I think you're working on something new. So, like, what are you working on, like, right now, like today?
Today I'm working on the third Keezy app. Keezy is my company that makes music apps, and we make easy to use, fun, colorful apps. And the first one was a sampler where you could record and play back sounds, and the second was a little easy to use drum machine, and then the third one is a totally revolutionary music format. And I was thinking, because I just want to talk about it so badly. I've been working on it for about 20 months with my team. And I can't talk about it too much yet. Because, like, I think it's just a bad idea to talk about products, and especially technology products, before they're out.
Is that like a belief that's evolved over time for you?
Yeah.
Because you used to be a person who lived a bit more in public than you do now.
Yeah, very much. I was on the front lines of making everything public on the internet, which is a horrible way to live, but someone had to be the first one to do it. Someone had to eat the poison berries first so everyone else could know not to eat the berries. But yeah, I used to put almost everything online impulsively, and quickly found that 99% of stuff you don't actually want to put online.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to reflect back on since I've been, like, doing this show, because one of the things I ask people to do to come on this show is to come on and talk about smoking marijuana. And
sweet,
in some ways,
sweet weed.
In some ways, that's not like a huge ask in 2017. Yeah. It wouldn't shock most people that most of their friends have at least tried marijuana, but there is still, like, a taboo around that stuff.
Yeah.
When you were like blazing into the future and just like telling the world who you were you thinking that the world was going to be right behind you and that everyone was going to be living that way? And I guess you weren't really wrong if you were thinking that way.
Yeah. I mean, I was right that everyone would be publishing their personal lives online. I was wrong that they would reveal everything about themselves to millions of strangers. And that, you know, you can see now how very, even though it looks like people are constantly putting stuff online, they're actually very careful about what they put on.
Yeah, in some ways, I don't really know that much about young people today, but I think there was a perception that they were all just going to have lived in public forever and, like, not even notice. But actually, when I've talked to people who are, like, teenagers now, they have a very articulated, like, curated view of how one interacts with living in public, and, like, very strict boundaries and kind of ideas about it. It's like a culture has evolved around it rather than a free-for-all.
Mm.
Where are you from?
I'm from Baltimore, Maryland.
You're one of the few people who's told me about going to... You went to a Montessori school?
Oh, yeah.
Is that right? What? Tell me a little bit about Montessori schools.
Montessori schools... I mean, I'll preface it by saying, to me, it was normal. And I never went to... a conventional public school. So my basis for comparison is pretty weak. But basically, at a Montessori school, you know, from a very young age, you're in an environment where there's, you know, there aren't the normal desks. It's like you're in a, almost like a big living room, and there's shelves that have like physical learning activities / toys. And you like pick one up off the shelf and go to a table or go to the floor and kind of just play with it in the process you're learning about geometry or language or math.
One of the things you've done, a lot of software and computer projects and projects that even expand outside the idea of a computer. But one of the themes that I've noticed across your work is a lot of the idea of play. Like a lot of, I feel like technology has become a little bit overrun with business as the dominant metaphor. And I think of you as someone who comes very much to software with the idea of like almost physically playing with it. Where does that come from for you?
I mean, yeah, it's probably rooted back there to just being in a school that was like, it was just like toys basically. And you learned by interacting with the stuff directly. And I think more important than the learning materials being physical was the self-directed nature of it, which when kids are playing, they're just improvising.
Right.
And so it was fun to come into school and have sort of an improvisational ecosystem where you know, if it's like today I'm feeling geometry, so I'm going to play with these metal insets and like trace triangles. But if I was in the mood for botany, I could go look at, you know, models of flowers. And they even let me just make mazes and distribute them. I would photocopy them. So to me, from a young age, that was kind of the normal way of spending your day.
When did you first try marijuana?
Marijuana. At Montessori schools, they don't give you marijuana until you're... I believe the first time I tried it was in high school. And, like, for some reason, I was really hesitant to do any drugs. And, like, I was kind of proudly doing a straight edge thing for a while. I wouldn't drink a beer at a party and I wouldn't smoke weed. And then, for whatever reason, I just, like, realized that I didn't have any real reason for that. And I was like, let me try it. And so, it was funny because it was, like, flipping a switch. Like, I went from being... just sort of, you know, a nerd who didn't hang out with cool people to like literally in the course of like 2 hours telling someone like, hey, could I try smoking weed? And he's like, yeah, come with me after school. And then like all these cool kids were like, oh, Jake Lodwick's coming to smoke weed. And we like went to some, you know, park and all sat around and smoked and talked. And I was like, oh, this is great. It was just so chill. And something about smoking together is you can kind of hang out with whoever you're smoking with and suddenly you're kind of on that same level.
Yeah.
So I was hanging out with people who were, you know, quote unquote cool. It's hard to say in retrospect if anyone was actually cool in high school, but they definitely seemed like slightly bad into music, you know, into partying a little more.
What was the vibe around, like when you started like do like programming and like making websites, like what was that considered as an activity socially at that point?
I mean, it was definitely not cool in ninth grade.
Yeah.
I guess just to date that, ninth grade for me would have been like around 1996.
Yeah, I recall that period.
And I remember one particular memory was, I'd say my class of about 80 kids, there were maybe six of us who were pretty into computers. And I remember I was talking to my friend Andrew, about adding an extra disk drive to a computer. And my friend Chris was walking up and he saw us talking and he like kind of slowly walked up until he heard me saying like, oh, and then you make that one the B drive and the first one's the A drive. And he's like, I knew you guys were talking about computers. And so, yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of a like, you're a computer nerd vibe. Nothing malicious, but I think I just kind of from an early age, like related to them.
Yeah.
And as someone who's kind of on the autism spectrum, it was like really straightforward to deal with computers because they were relatively predictable and they're kind of just doing whatever you ask them to do.
Yeah.
And if there's an error, you can kind of identify the error without it getting mad at you. And so, yeah, I just remember like, you know, people being very confusing and intense, and computers being like so straightforward.
How did your relationship to people evolve over that time as you sort of became successful in doing a lot of the stuff in computers? So you started with College Humor when you were not that much older than that, right?
Yeah. College Humor was, would have been, you know, 4 years after that. And, I found out about the site freshman year of college up at RIT in Rochester, New York. And I would say that actually it was still in high school when people were starting to come to appreciate the computer skills kind of as the internet came in.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there were a couple things in high school, like I got really good at Photoshop. And so I made like pretty significant contributions to the school yearbook. That was kind of like some of the cooler kids were like, hey, Jake, will you design my yearbook page?
I was deep in the Photoshop game myself.
It was a superpower.
I had a fake ID game going.
You too?
They were, yes. There was like one template that you could download online.
Iowa?
Mine was New Jersey, which was like particularly unconvincing in California.
Yeah.
And I had like, I remember trying to cut... Like I had a lamination machine, but you had to cut a perfect circle.
Yeah.
And I just don't have that skill.
Yeah. It was cutting the corners, right?
Yeah. The cutting the corners. Yeah. You can't do that as an amateur.
You can't cut corners.
Yeah.
How much were you charging for yours?
I never got to the point where they were good enough that I could charge money.
Yeah.
They were mostly like a project I put like a lot of energy into that had pretty bad results. I did use my own.
Yeah.
I felt like using my own was kind of like do your own drugs if you like grow them.
Yeah, your own
like,
dog food.
I was like, I have to use this a few times before I like send someone else to jail.
The Iowa ID was just like, looked like it was made in Microsoft Word.
Yeah.
And so I got a template online and then figured out in Photoshop I could like pretty easily, you know, customize it for someone, print it out, cut the corners so they were curved, you know, got the laminator from Staples, and I made one for I think my friend John. And then like word got out that I was making them. And so then one day I came in, I had like a thermos and I was just collecting money from people. I was only collecting $15 per, I could have charged 100, but I was just like psyched to be doing it.
I remember puzzling through, like, I was like, I got to figure out what this font is.
Yeah.
And I tried every font that came back to Photoshop. I was like, none of these look right. And then I was like, wait. If everything is just the same letters that are currently here, I can cut and paste the letters and move them around to spell anything.
That's a lot of work, man.
That was like my first experience with layering in Photoshop, I think. And then eventually I was like, oh, I'll make a set where I cut every letter out.
Yeah.
And then I'll be able to drag and drop them in and spell things.
That's the Gutenberg technique. So that went great. I collected like $130 from other students. And then... Yeah. So then I was at home and I had Photoshop on my computer at home and I was going through the IDs for people. And then there was a knock on my bedroom door. So I turned off the monitor and then opened the door and it's my mom. And she's like, I just talked to John so-and-so's mom. And she said, you made him a fake ID. And I was like, huh? And then she walks in and just turns on the monitor. And I had a 19-inch monitor I signed up for. And it was zoomed all the way in on Kim such and such's Iowa ID.
Yeah.
And it was the most incriminating possible moment. She's like, you need to stop that. And I was like, but I already collected money from everyone. She's like, give the money back. And so I was like kind of mad. But then I realized, oh, shit, this is like a really... If I gotten caught by someone, not my mom, totally screwed.
I mean, when you look at like your own trajectory, so you started working on this site, College Humor, which like, I don't know, people at that point, I remember being on College Humor. Like,
nice.
Actually, I know, I, I don't know if I ever visited it myself. I remember visiting someone else's dorm room, and he had this Russian roommate, and he was like, "You got to look at this." And it was like some kind of like, it was like a photo on College Humor. And then he was just like, it was like my first experience where some dude was like, "Let me show you a viral video."
Yeah.
Except it was like, this was in like 2000 ish. Right. Am I in the right time period?
Started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you, when you look back on that, which is like an atypical thing for the rest of your life, but also like propelled you in many ways towards it, do you look at that as like a lucky situation or a situation that you were fated to end up in?
That's a great question. There was something fateful about College Humor, I think, because there were many opportunities for me to get teamed up with the guys who started it. Because we were from Timonium, Maryland, but I didn't know them in high school.
Yeah.
I would have gone to their high school, Delaney, but I went to Friends, which was a private school. Delaney was a public school. So I would have known them, and we would have gotten into trouble in high school, but we didn't know each other. And then we were in separate colleges, and I found out about them because my friend saw the site and was like, "Yo, check out College Humor." And they found out about me the same weekend from someone they knew. And so there were like at least three paths that all could have connected me to them. I mean, it follows. It's like you're from the same town. Like, I had a very particular set of skills that was unusual for a college freshman, and they did too.
Yeah.
And so it seemed like, I feel like I would have connected with them just because we needed each other and there weren't that many other candidates.
What was it like being part? I mean, not only was that a massive like ascent at the time, there wasn't any real model for it. It wasn't like, it's like the Facebook thing. Like, it's like, I didn't know anyone who'd like had a popular website then.
Yeah.
I'm like, I didn't even really know how it worked. I was like, what, like, how do you make a, like, where does it live? Like, I literally, if you'd asked me at the time, I would have been like, "Oh, he's probably got like a Mac Mini at his house or something." And it's like serving up that file. Like, I didn't even have the perspective on what it would mean to be running a website in 2000.
Well, I mean, you're right about the Mac Mini. I had a Windows PC in my dorm room that I was running my personal site off of, which had original videos I'd made and had like crazy layout and everything. And that's what they had seen. And they were like, "Oh, we should get this guy involved.
Yo, he's got videos."
It's 2000. He's got videos. Yeah. That was unusual for the time, and just like HTML and stuff. Those basic skills. But I mean, there's nothing in principle preventing you from running a website off of Mac Mini. In fact, there's whole server companies that do nothing but that. But in order to have it handled with more capacity, you know, we had servers at a co-location facility.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting time to remember back on in culture, where there was like the sort of intersection of like geekiness, like frattiness, and nascent meme-iness.
Yeah.
That we didn't know what it was called then, you know?
Meme-iness.
Those things don't like all like align in the same way anymore, you know?
Those
people don't all party together anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really evolved in a crazy, like, if you could have gone from what College Humor, really what the web was like in 2000 to today, I mean, it's just, it's, you could never have predicted the scale and the variety and the intensity. And I mean, I just find it kind of upsetting. Like, I spend very little time online.
Yeah.
When possible, because it's just, it doesn't really feel right to me. It's not ergonomic, and it's not designed by people who are trying to create great spaces to learn and play. It's designed by a very small number of, you know, autism spectrum San Franciscans and Valley people who, I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say they have no conscience. Maybe that's a bit of a misnomer. What they have in place of a conscience is a mandate from their leaders who tell them that it's okay and do it in such a way that it sort of turns off their critical thinking. And those who think critically get ejected from the organizations.
What was your experience of working within that world and then exiting it like?
It hadn't quite gotten...
You started Vimeo in what year?
2004.
Okay.
I'd say back to college humor for a second, that's where I really experienced the sort of relentless optimization to addict people and hook them in. Because we had, at the time, the most popular thing on College Humor was the picture pages.
Mm.
So every day there would be, you know, 150 photos submitted, and we would pick the best 12 and post those. And each photo would have its own page. And at some point we were like, oh, let's put smaller thumbnails of other photos under the main photo that you're looking at. And people will click those, and then we'll get another page. So, you know, we initially just had like two or three, and then that was going well. People were clicking them, and we were like, oh, let's use a different algorithm to pick which photos are shown. No, let's try four instead of three, and we'll do a test where half the people will get one, half will get another, simple A-B test. And I was like, where does this end? Because we can just keep optimizing, and, you know, what are we really trying to do here? And then it starts turning into a philosophical question.
I feel like this is a movie we just hard cut right now to a, like, 15 celebrities who've, like, killed people with their automobile.
Yeah.
It's like, it takes about 15 to 17 years.
Yeah. You won't believe how ugly this child star has become. Yeah. That is just today's evolution of the question that we were struggling with then.
Yeah.
Of how do we balance the interests of our business with the well-being of our users? And the short answer is that you substitute actual concern with well-being for users with the lie that they're on your website to have fun, or they're on your website because they want to be there.
Yeah.
And you look at engagement and say, oh, this change produced an increase in engagement. Therefore, it's good for everybody, and we're making the world a better place.
Is it hard? You described your own mind as autism spectrum. So, like, I would have not use that word. I would allow you to use that about yourself, but I would not
Thank
use
you.
It about you. But is there like an internal dilemma going on in your mind where you're like, my mind knows how to optimize for clicking. Like, mm-hmm. I understand the idea of an algorithm that slowly picks the perfect photo.
Right.
Yet there's this other part of my mind that's going, that's not a good idea.
Yeah.
Like, at one point did you like become aware that those minds were divergent?
Yeah, I think it was when I was figuring out what the algorithm would be for the related photos on College Humor.
Yeah.
And that
it was,
you
like,
know,
a T2 moment where you just like saw like barreling smoke and fire in the future.
Oh yeah. I didn't so much picture ahead what the consequences would be as actually being stuck philosophically with,
why
the question of, yeah, why are we doing this? And I remember asking it to a group of ad salespeople at College Humor. I was like, what is our real purpose here?
The fuck are we here?
And they were like, they all looked at me like I was a fucking idiot. They're like, to make money, idiot. Yeah. And I was like, but there's got to be more than that, because also, even if you're just trying to make money, what makes money this week versus what makes money over 10 years?
Yeah.
Two very different questions. So I think for the long term, you actually will end up caring more about the well-being of your users. But if it's just the short term, you'll use every trick in the book to get them hooked. And that's the world we live in right now, is everybody is totally hooked on these like digital drugs, basically. And only now are we starting to have a conversation about the moral responsibility of the people building these systems.
What was your relationship to actual drugs like during the period that you were like learning about the mind drug that is the internet?
I would say around that time, I was only doing drugs whenever possible. I mean, while we're on the subject of mental health, I mean, I already talked about being on the spectrum, but, you know, I also have a mild bipolar condition diagnosed as cyclothymic, which is like kind of lots of hypomanic states and occasional crashes if I don't go for the graceful landing. And I didn't know I had that or that susceptibility. So even though I no longer have manic episodes, back in 2005, when I was the only programmer at College Humor and the College Humor ad system and the t-shirt site and Vimeo, in order to meet the demands of my job, I would take a magical pill called Adderall and just go.
Yeah.
And then have to eventually sleep. So, you know, smoke a little weed, which I thought made you tired, but it actually doesn't do that to me. So, yeah, I mean, for me, kind of all the work I've ever done is tied up into some sort of drug use, even if it's minor. Now it's like pretty minor. Like, I do a lot of pretty, you know, relatively small doses of mostly marijuana weed.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I feel like I ended up in the same place as you. I took a different path. You're a person who's written a lot about creativity. You've done a lot of projects and different mediums. Yeah. I mean, in addition to the stuff you're talking about, like Vimeo, which are these projects that people know, you've also like had like personal video series and like pretty like out, like if it was jazz, I would call it avant-garde jazz. So you're not like a person who doesn't express themselves. Like what part of your mind does that like more creative, like I'm not making a business, I'm like in like lycra, like full body suit kind of part come from?
I think that that's actually the root of it. I mean, Vimeo was really a, it came out of my short films I was making.
Yeah.
And, without getting too detailed in it, it was just, I needed to make my own video hosting platform and there weren't any. So I programmed one using like spare parts left over from College Humor. And it, to me, it, any great product has art at the foundation, any great technical product or service. And you could say, well, I don't know if that's true. I've looked at Silicon Valley and those people don't have an artistic bone in their body, but they are inspired by art. They're inspired by films. I mean,
and counterculture.
Oh yeah. Big time. They don't produce it, but it is there at the root. It's like, if you're trying to do some crazy technological thing and you try to describe it for what it literally is, people won't get it. But if you say, oh, it's like Minority Report, then they'll be like, oh, great.
Yeah.
It's like this thing in Star Trek. It's like that. It's like from Star Wars. Anything that people have seen in movies can then be used as the basis of a technical startup.
Yeah.
So I think one area where I'm different there is I usually make the art myself and then use computers to like bring it to life or take it to the next level.
So in a way you could say like in starting something like Vimeo, you weren't prescient that everyone was going to want to put videos on the internet in the future so much as you were serving your own need at a high level.
Yeah. I mean, it was both. It was serving my own need. And then as I felt really good about my need being served and saw it resonating with other people, then I started extrapolating and I was like, everybody's going to be shooting video all the time. And that was actually where I had that manic episode. My one true manic episode was as a right as I was creating Vimeo and just becoming aware of just a sense of where this was going and how crazy it was that you could broadcast your own movies that you made on your computer.
Yeah. Working on all these creative projects. So you now have this project Keezy that's like at its most elemental level or the very first level was like a cool sampler for your iPhone, but like so in a way that I hadn't seen before and has really like kind of expanded from that idea. But again, it's like something that I can see you playing with. I'm curious, like when you're trying to build something that like solves your own problem like that and your own problem is kind of like wanting to play.
Yeah. I think there's a commonality in humans that we tend to like similar things. And the best way to identify what that is to just see it in yourself or someone you love or otherwise really care about. If you're making something, you should have a muse and it should either be yourself or someone that you have to truly care about them. And there's kind of no way around that. You have to want them to be happy. And then by picking that person, and I'll write it down, like when I'm writing out my engineering specifications for what I'm going to build, part of the specification is who the muse is.
It reminds me, Francis Starlight was on this show.
He's
someone we both know.
To the extent that he is knowable.
Yeah, yeah. he's unknown to both of us. and there was something striking to me like when we were talking about writing songs where it's like when you're writing a song, you can't describe, you can't really like set out what your goal is. You can't be like, we're going to do like a like you kind of have to like let certain things come naturally. Right. Like no one wants to hear a song that was like planned by a committee prior to it being written. So I'm interested, like as you're sort of following your intuition mm-hmm. down these paths. Like, how do you deal with doubt? And how do you also deal with like letting go of like what you thought the original, like I've seen like Vimeo, like your original like notepad. And it's like, if you had dogmatically pursued that original vision,
yeah.
Vimeo would not have been what it is at all.
Yeah.
I'm curious like what the lives of your ideas are.
Ah, that's a cool question. When you brought up Francis, I thought you were going to refer to the fact that he knows something's good when he starts moving, he starts yeah. dancing to it. And that's precisely how the process I was describing of, he makes music that makes him move.
Yeah.
That, and there's no substitute. It's like he puts it on, and if his body just starts like bouncing and his spine is moving around,
yeah.
then he knows it's good. But yeah, so the life of the ideas, it's just so crazy, because at any given moment in time, you know how you feel about it and you have a sense of where it's going.
Yeah.
But that future is not real. It's just imagination. And in my mind, the point of that vision is not that it prescribes what you're going to have done. It's a lure that makes you excited to keep working on it, because a project dies when you stop working on it.
Right.
So if there's some vision you have, even if it's not going to happen, the fact that you want it to happen causes you to keep working on it. And that's, again, why having a muse, and ideally it's you or someone you really love, because that motivates you to work on it to the exception of every other project you could be working on.
You also know when to let things die. And that's yeah. like, that's something that exists in the world of technology that often isn't built into some forms of art, where mm. it's like, there's a culture within software and technology of like killing your darlings and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And I've been surprised in some of the things that you've been working on where you're like, nope, it's done.
Yeah. Well, like, those were usually mistakes from being immature.
Yeah.
Well,
it still takes something. I mean, there's people who are still dragging around the albatross of like mistakes they made many years ago.
Yeah.
It seems like there's been an evolution for you where you're like, I don't know, you describe being in a manic state. You seem like, yeah. I've known you for probably like 10 years and you yeah. seem like chiller now.
Oh yeah.
and you also seem like you're kind of like enjoying this stuff more for its own sake than yeah. ever before.
I mean, first off, I'll apologize for who I was for the first 5 years you knew me. I've been digitizing or transferring all my old mini DV tapes.
Yeah.
I cannot stand my personality from back then. Like,
really?
Yeah. It's just not a,
I mean, I feel know. Sort of, I don't know. It's I feel like it's sometimes scary to like be too hard on like your younger self. Cause it's like,
yeah,
you know, well, like what do you know? Like, what do you feel like changed?
It's just like a little bit of know thyself, just trying to know myself and do therapy, self therapy, and just try to get a little better every day. And, you know, undoing all the autism spectrum personality stuff. I was describing to my mom, I was like, let's say Asperger's syndrome. I view it as a forest, and it's made up of individual trees. And those trees are little personality traits that have grown out of this soil of hypersensitivity. For me, everything is, I feel like the volume's turned up. I'm pretty sure that compared to normal people, I experience stuff with more intensity. And I think that hypersensitivity is the root condition that causes autism spectrum traits to grow.
Hmm.
That is that, for example, you look at someone's face and you're overwhelmed by their face because it's so much information. And then they seem to be mad at you for a second and you think they're furious or you feel you did something wrong. And these sort of overreactions, you know, you develop almost a, it'd be like if you had a house and the music was blasting out of one room, you might just close the door to that room and never go in. And your familiarity with that music will be less than someone who has normal hearing.
Yeah.
I have better hearing. Wouldn't I hear it better? No, it was too loud. I had to close the door.
Yeah. And you can't enjoy it.
Can't enjoy it. And so, you know, when I walked in here, I asked you to turn down the lights. And it's like, I just, you know, I have a mind that's a gift and a curse, but it all seems to be rooted in having just a hyper intense brain where every thought, feeling, and sensory input is like turned up to 10 or 11. And that causes weird personality traits to emerge. And now in my 30s, I'm trying to undo all that crap because it's garbage.
But it's also like given you incredible. I mean, like if you ask me how I perceived you, like in the first few years I knew you, I was like, that dude's like pretty intense. But I was like, he clearly like knows how to do something, you know, like there was a lot of people running around when we were 25 years old who were like, I'm like big shit. I do shit. And then like, you know, you were able to like really pull things off in some ways using that energy. I'm curious how using marijuana interacts with that brain chemistry and like has been a good, bad, good and bad thing for you.
Yeah. I was trying to prepare for this interview is like, it's so hard to describe the effect that marijuana has.
I mean, it was fascinating to hear how you describe your own brain state sort of as a natural chemistry. And then I'm like wondering what happens when you start layering on that chemistry.
Yeah. Weed just makes it kind of blissful and it takes the edge off.
Mm.
And it also makes music sound really great. So, I mean, literally, I think my favorite activity is go home to my little padded room with the blackout curtains, lock the door, put on my headphones, smoke some weed, lay down, and just like vibe out to music in some alternate, you know, it's like the float tanks in Stranger Things. It's like, just go somewhere else and kind of, you know, let the mind do its own internal show.
Yeah.
I would say getting high around other people is fun, but you can kind of quickly get a little out of sync sometimes.
Sure.
I don't find it super social. To me, it's the ultimate alone drug.
I agree.
Yeah.
And I find that it like pushes me in certain alone places that I really like, I find it very comforting that if like nothing else, I could like spend the rest of my life just watching movies and listening to music. Like,
well, now if we take that comforting thought and project it 15 years in the future, you know, one of the visions of the future is that, you know, Terminators are going to rise up and kill us. But to me, it's more like a consensual version of the scene from The Matrix where, I mean, these things are just going to kind of sedate us, I think. And, you know, if you think about, oh man, can I tell you what I think is really going to sedate humanity?
Please.
I kind of want to build this, so I'm like hesitant to talk about it, but.
I feel like you already like were involved in one thing that like slightly destroyed humanity. And you're like, you got another great idea that will like destroy humanity again.
Yeah. See, I have to do it in a way where the copycats of the world can't do it faster after they see me invent it.
Got it.
And this is kind of a theme. I definitely have a bit of a chip on my shoulder because I've been the inventor of several ideas and products that then other people have done on a larger scale.
Such as
shitty.
Vimeo predating YouTube.
Vimeo predating YouTube, Campus Hook predating Facebook. And, you know, let me just be clear that, like, due to my inferior execution, those things won.
Yeah.
I don't have any sense that they cheated or that they somehow don't deserve, you know, the success that they had.
Yeah.
I'm just frustrated with myself that I didn't do a good enough job, that the dominant thing is the best thing.
Mm.
And that's what one of the things I'm really trying to nail with this new Keezy app. So we've figured out a way that people, any person of any age and musical background, can get into a musical flow state.
You've, like, I remember you've had a, like, the idea of flow state has been of interest to you for a while.
Oh, yeah.
You've written about, like, you know, like different ways to like organize desks in like a startup with like flags to say, you know, here's where my brain is.
Like,
do not disturb. Tell me about like where that comes from in you and what you've learned from studying that flow state.
Mm. Yeah. So to me, to just make sure everyone's on the same page, if the flow state that we're describing is when you are immersed in an activity that is in a sweet spot of being challenging enough that it requires your full attention, but also doable. And it's not so hard that you can't do it. And this type of activity, it could be writing, it could be dancing, it could be computer programming. It could kind of be, I think, just about any activity, but it's very fragile.
Hmm.
And in everything I do, I'm seeking these flow states. And, you know, I'm not a religious person. I'd say my spirituality comes from this peak experience that I get when I'm in creative flow states.
Yeah.
That's everything. I'm always looking for that. And I want to give that to other people and help them understand that the most value you can create professionally and the most fun you can have comes from getting in these states. But you have to put the work into setting up the environment, both the physical environment and the sort of project management environment where you can get in them. And so that's kind of the baseline in almost everything I do, is looking for that flow state, because that's where people end up. That's where genius comes out. Like, I don't think people can be a genius without flow states.
You are friendly with lots of artists. Like, I remember, like, the first time I think I came to your house, Reggie Watts, like, came wandering out of, like, a bathroom.
Yeah.
And you work with musicians. You had, like, a record label. Do you think that flow state that you're describing is the same in art as it is in programming or anything else?
Yeah.
Do you draw any distinctions there?
No. I think it's the same thing. I think it's just different content. It's like eating. It's still eating, whether you're eating pizza or snails.
Is being in a business restrictive for you? Like, do you have to think like, oh, like, I shouldn't say that, or like, I shouldn't put up this weird video. Like, I'm going to have like a business meeting next week.
Yeah.
I shouldn't talk about smoking weed on a podcast.
Yeah. I was thinking that. And, you know, things I would love to talk about, like, you know, other drugs, you know, I'm probably not going to discuss today, but with weed, I mean, I'm in the music business now, and like, if you don't smoke weed, that's a problem. And I feel like one of the cool things about the music business is like, you kind of have to like build up your weed tolerance.
You really do, especially in Los Angeles.
LA is insane. I can't believe LA.
I can't imagine you in LA. I feel like LA, like the pace, like what's LA like for you?
I've had 3 LA trips in the past couple months. And first off, it's simply an alternate reality to New York. The weather, the people, the drugs, it feels like 40 years in the future with drugs. And it's like, I get there, I'm like, I tell a friend like, hey, I don't have any weed. Could you hook me up? And then they give me like a bag with like cookies, gummies, pre-rolled blunts, pre-rolled joints, bags of regular nugs. And it's like a treasure chest from your wildest imagination. And I'm like, how much do I owe you? They're like, oh, $60.
Yeah.
I'm like, $60? That's what I paid freshman year of school for like shake,
like
a little bit of trash marijuana. And so you go out there and you kind of have to set your own limits. If you don't set your own limits, then you're just gonna OD basically.
Where do you think weed is gonna go in America?
Into my lungs. I mean, it would be cool if you could come to New York and smoke it and not get thrown in a fucking cage. You know, the fucking craziest thing about so many of the illegal drugs that I've played with and found value in, especially mushrooms, is it's therapeutic. It's the most therapeutic thing. A mild mushroom dose can allow you to like undo, you know, weird nervous system neuroses and anxieties, and allow you to see things that you hadn't seen before. And I mean, I feel like there's something there to the fact that the most therapeutic substances are illegal.
Like, what's exciting to you right now? I don't even know what the format to ask. Like, what do you? But like, what is exciting to you in the world right now?
I would say we're in a really good time and place for media consumption, because technology has enabled different modes of consumption: video games, podcasts, on-demand movies and TV shows, audiobooks.
What excites you about that media stuff you're talking about? Like something like podcasting, which is not a futuristic technology. It's like RSS as applied to like a series of MP3.
Yeah.
Like those kinds of media. Like what's exciting to you about those experiences now?
I love the immersion of contemporary media.
Yeah.
If you want it, you can have it. If you're spending all your time on social media feeds on your smartphone, you won't have it. But if you open up a movie and watch it in HD on a projector, you know, I mean, giant TVs are not even expensive now.
Yeah.
And so the immersion that I experience with a video game or a good movie it's a flow state. And I can really get it to another world. And man, I love experiencing that stuff alone because of the aforementioned hypersensitivity applies to emotions too. So I'll put on like Moana and I'm like crying through the whole thing because it's just emotionally overpowering to see even like someone dancing. And so I like to do that alone of just like, okay, I'm going to put on a movie and just cry and get that like sort of emotional release.
So for the end of the show, you feeling good? You all right?
I'm great right now.
Okay. So for the end of the show, we do a little quiz. It's called Peak Experiences. The first question I like to ask is, when you do go down, into the dark room, to enjoy your solo time, what is your favorite way if you are smoking weed, to smoke?
I like to smoke with a bubbler.
Hmm.
Something where the smoke is filtered through water and ice and that it's kind of cold and clean tasting.
What's a place that you've visited that was really memorable to you?
I really liked New Zealand. I stayed out in Auckland for about a month, just like rented a room in my friend's flat. This was kind of like right after college ended, so 2003. And it just felt like the world was a smaller place. And there was less to think about and less to worry about. And I felt like everything I needed was right there. Like we were across the street from like an independent record store and there was a Thai restaurant in the mall. And I was like meeting people and it just kind of felt like a toned down version of the real world.
Do you have a favorite snack?
I'm completely unable to control myself when cashews are in the room.
Yeah.
I cannot stop eating cashews when they're around. And by the way, have you seen what cashews grow like?
They have like, it's like a weird like fruit that grows around them, right?
It's like an apple. It's like a poison apple and they're like a little dingus coming out the top.
Yeah, I went through an area of India where they were growing cashews and it was like this like rotten, rancid fruit rotting on the ground. Everyone were like, oh, cashews. I was like, that is not what I know to be cashews. Do you have a favorite in recent memory stoned viewing experience? Movie, TV, web video?
What about video games?
Video games count.
Yes, I got to have, this section is called Peak Experiences, and I got to have one recently with, I was with David O'Reilly, who's a filmmaker turned video game maker, and I went to his place in LA, and he showed me his game Everything, and this was like maybe a month or two before it came out, and I got to get super high on the projector and just have like developers commentary, beyond developers commentaries, developer conversation. And he got to like watch me play with it and like observe me as a user. And I got to talk to him as the game developer. And meanwhile, the game is completely mind blowing. And I was just like, this is what it's all about. And I was like, that's kind of creativity that I'm like, you know, always in search of, and really impressed when people pull it off, man. When someone pulls off some groundbreaking, crazy, unprecedented thing, it's like fully executed with like expert craftsmanship and they like just nailed every detail. That's just what it's all about. And it reminds you that you can do those things.
You're on a desert island. You're going to basically have one repetitive listening experience for the rest of your life, which is to say you'll be allowed to bring one piece of CD media with you. What do you bring?
Just to be clear, it's not stuck on repeat. I can play it.
No, you can play it like you could never play it if you want.
Okay.
It's just great. It's just all you have with you.
So I can always go back to silence.
Yeah. You can use it as a coaster if you want.
Yeah, I definitely have had a transcendent experience listening to Radiohead on DMT. That was sort of a guiding light for like the level of experience I could create in software. So I think if I were on the desert island, I could play this one track off OK Computer.
Yeah.
And then I'd be like, okay, you know, I'm going to keep at it. And then maybe I get rescued.
What's one thing that you're still looking forward to that you have ahead of you in life?
I think being an old person is going to be super interesting.
Thank you very much, Jake Lodwick.
Oh, I was just getting started.
No, tell people, if people want to kind of keep up with what you're doing, how can they find you?
If I'm doing my job right, they'll just see it.
And that was Stoner. This week I edited it myself. Could you tell? I hope not. I'm just finishing it up right now. Tuesday, about to post it on the internet. We have a new episode coming to you every Tuesday. If there's someone you'd love to hear on the show, send me an email. hi@stoner.co. That's hi@stoner.co. See you next week.